Here on FM, it's 20 years since a little-known member of Britain's aristocracy first stumbled onto our TV screens. The adventures of Edmund Blackadder and his faithful servant Baldric began on the eve of the Battle of Bosworth Field in 1485 and ended memorably on another battlefield 500 years later. In between, viewers retreated to some of the funniest British comedy of recent years. Now, John Lloyd, the producer of Blackadder, recalls the making of a comedy classic.
What would you expect? After all, who has the fastest brain in the land?
Prince Edmund, Duke of Edinburgh.
Who is the boldest horseman in the land?
Prince Edmund,
Duke of Edinburgh.
Who is the bravest swordsman in the land?
Oh, don't tell me that's that Earl from Norfolk.
Prince Edmund, Duke of Edinburgh. Precisely. Or, as I shall be known from now on, the Black Vegetable.
Alnwick Castle in Northumberland is now known to millions as the exterior of Hogwarts in the Harry Potter movies. But a long, long time ago, in February 1983, it was there that several cocky young 20-somethings set out to create history, starting in 1485. The producer was described by the writer Richard Curtis as the oldest person I know, apart from my mother. That was me, and I was 31. For some long-forgotten reason, the shoot began with the last episode, a key scene where Prince Edmund sets out from his father's castle to seek the seven most evil men in the land and return to seize the kingdom. Sitting on his horse, before a cast and crew of about 100, with lurchers and pennants and knights and braziers and God knows what else, as we waited for the camera to turn over in the freezing drizzle, Rowan leant down from his mighty steed, his nose pitifully running, and snuffled, "What voice should I use?" Given the extraordinary talent assembled for Blackadder and its subsequent acclaim, it must seem obvious to everyone that it was all plain sailing and an enormous lark. But nothing could be further from the truth, even though it had all started so well.
Richard Curtis and I had been very much involved with Not the 9 o'clock News, which was a topical comedy sketch show of the time, and for some reason we started to think about the possibility of writing a sitcom. And I remember we both felt the sort of scourge of Fawlty Towers, which was the dominant sitcom of the time, and it was sort of hanging over us as something to which we were bound to be unfavourably compared. We were fairly convinced that whatever we did, set in the modern day, was going to be described as a pale imitation of Fawlty Towers, or, you know, Fawlty Towers could show them a thing or two, or whatever. And that, I think, was one of the main reasons why we ended up thinking about a period sitcom.
I just got a script dropped through my letterbox in Bristol, and it was for this new project called Blackadder, and there was this part for a servant in it, and it was an offer. Now, no one just offered me parts at that time. I would always have to go up to London and do about 19 auditions and interviews, and I was terribly flattered, and I thought, oh, fantastic, people are realising my true comic worth at last. It's only later that I realised that virtually every other small comic actor in London had turned the part down. All that had happened was that the head of television comedy at the time had seen me a couple of years previously playing a part in a thing for BBC Bristol and had written me down in his book as small and vaguely humorous. And he was so near the end of his list that he'd suddenly found me and offered me the part, because otherwise they wouldn't have been able to make the thing. So that's how I got into it.
Ah, and what is your name, little fellow?
My name is Baldric.
Then I shall call you Baldric.
And I shall call you my lord.
I like the cut of your jib, young fellow, me lad. How would you like to be my squire in the battle tomorrow?
We wanted a sort of a fairly serious but exciting, adventurous title that might sound like the kind of title you'd give a film set in medieval times. We wanted it to be sort of, you know, dark and exciting. And I remember another sort of a touchstone for us both was the Errol Flynn Robin Hood movie, which we thought was definitive in terms of its way of presenting, albeit in a slightly Hollywood-esque way, you know, the excitement of that time, of the 15th century.
The first series of Blackadder was by far the least enjoyable to make. We were all absurdly disorganised and overambitious. Roan was sacked from doing any actual writing quite early in the series. He was far too busy trying to learn the lines, which we pushed under his hotel room door at 4 a.m. for the next day's shoot. But the series had its high points, and episode 3, with the famous scene where Baldric sorts through a pile of sacred relics supposedly made by Jesus in his carpentry shop, including a very nice cheese board, won an international Emmy. This wasn't enough, however, to save the show from being summarily cancelled by Michael Grade when he arrived as managing director of BBC Television. This was a horrible shock. By that time, Ben Elton had come on board and 4 brilliant episodes had already been written. We'd got rid of the vast sets, the hordes of film extras and the horses, and decided to reinstate the studio audience. By working around the clock over one weekend, cutting out every last shred of exterior film and shrinking the budget to the size and simplicity of Baldric's cerebellum, we were able to convince the BBC to give us just one more chance.
I think we all knew from the beginning that the first series was pretty dire, but it was a bit like a production line, that once you've started it off, you can't just stop it straight away, because in our case, we'd already cast the actors, the costumes were made, the locations were sorted out and paid for, everything was booked. You just have to go through with it and make it as good as you can. But if you think about it, no one had made the kind of historical comedy half-hour series that Richard and Roan had got in their minds. And it wasn't until we'd started work that we could actually see what worked and what didn't.
Series one, we bit off slightly more than we could chew, is the truth of the matter. And in Roan's character, amongst other things, we tried to do lots of things. We tried to make him sort of arrogant, scared, feeble, bullying. We tried to do a really rounded thing. And the truth of the matter is, it was sort of too much for a character to hold. And when we got down to series two, we just picked 2 qualities and made him simpler. And then once we picked the 2 qualities, he could then become increasingly complicated through the episodes and through the series.
For the second series, of course, Richard was joined by Ben Elton. And the two of them sort of, rather bravely, I thought, decided quite consciously to make the central character less silly, less comic, less daft, and made him sort of rather cool and sardonic and cynical, and even in my bearded a manifestation, some claimed, rather good-looking. And I think that was definitely a very important turning point and started to provide, you know, that provided the template of sort of witty cynicism which so characterised the Blackadder through the remaining series, 2nd, 3rd and 4th.
Tell me, young crone, is this Putney?
That it be?
Yes, it is, not that it be. You don't have to talk in that stupid voice to me. I'm not a tourist. I seek information about a wise woman.
The wise woman. The wise woman.
Yes, the wise woman.
2 things, my lord, must ye know of the wise woman.
Yes?
First, she is a woman. And second, she is...
wise.
You do know her, then?
No. Just a wild stab in the dark, which is incidentally what you'll be getting if you don't start being a bit more helpful.
Despite our efforts to disguise the provenance of the series, there are in fact only 7 plots, and in many ways Blackadder is actually Fawlty Towers in tights, with Rowan Atkinson as Basil perennially poking Tony Robinson's Manuel with a pencil. Casting Tony was just one of the many lucky breaks we really had done nothing to deserve. And in my opinion, it's Baldric, rather than Blackadder himself, who gives the show its enduring mainstream appeal. For Baldric is every man, the decent, sensible, downtrodden drudge, saddled with a boss who is both too clever by 3/4 and nearly always wrong. Nobody ever forgets Baldric, and not merely because several of the British Army's regimental goats are named after him.
In the first series, Baldric was by far the smartest of Blackadder and Percy and Baldric. But one of the realisations was that you couldn't just have a Roan character who was just completely stupid. He needed in his own world to be brilliant. But in order for him to be brilliant. You had to have two real thickies who were his sidekicks. And so Ben Elton, I think, had the idea that Baldrick should be the stupidest person in the history of human beings. And you can see as the series goes on that Baldrick actually gets thicker and thicker and thicker.
Right, Baldrick, let's try again, shall we? This is called adding. If I have two beans and then I add two more beans, what do I have?
Some beans.
Yes. And no. Let's try again, shall we? I have two beans, then I add two more beans. What does that make?
A very small casserole.
Baldrick, the ape creatures of the Indus have mastered this. Now try again. One, two, three, four. So how many are there?
Three.
What?
And that one.
Series 2, with a fresh writing team and a fresh cast, was the least problematic and the most fun to make. The scripts were very good to start with and suffered the least interference. For many people, it remains their favourite, with all their favourite people.
I was completely at home right from the start with Nursey. Innocent, scatological, and most incredibly stupid. A very warped and weird view on life, and just so sweetly gormless. But a rather loving creature. I mean, I liked her.
I bring grave intelligence of your former favourite, Lord Blackadder.
Oh, God!
It appears he wishes to marry a girl called Bob.
That's a very odd name for a girl, isn't it? Girls are normally called Elizabeth. Or Mary.
And Donald.
Mouth is open, Nursey, should be shut.
But it's true, sweet one. I had three sisters and they were called Donald, Eric and Basil.
Then why's your name Nursey?
That ain't my real name.
Isn't it?
No.
What is your real name, then?
Bernard.
Suits you, actually.
We had seen more than 40 actresses for the part and were beginning to despair. On the very last audition of the very last day, in walked a scruffy, slightly distracted-looking girl with unwashed hair. But by the time she had spoken a single sentence, Richard and I knew we had found our rightful queen. Miranda Richardson, not to mince pies, is quite simply a genius, the sort of person who gives acting a good name. Her well of creativity is so bottomless and so brimming with such mysterious liquids that directing her is pointless. The words are merely the parallel bars on which she performs her stunning emotional gymnastics.
When we auditioned for that part, we auditioned a lot of girls, many of whom became famous afterwards, but everybody did it in a very two-dimensional way. And then Miranda came in and she was just completely bizarre, you know, a strange mixture of sort of woman, child, nymphomaniac, tyrant. And I remember that in a way, every line got changed afterwards. She could do what we wrote, but we actually then wrote something much more in her direction.
Your Majesty!
Oh, hello, stranger.
I seek your permission to wed.
So I hear. Nancy, what do you think of all this?
I must profess, madam, I am astonished that Blackadder could possibly have eyes for any other woman than yourself.
Good point, though slightly grovelly. Ah.
But when I fell in love, ma'am, I didn't know she was a woman. I thought she was a boy.
Oh, of course, that makes it perfectly acceptable.
Oh, all right. Go on and marry her.
Thank you, ma'am.
Just tell me one thing. Is her nose as pretty as mine?
Oh, no, 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 ma'am.
Oh, God. Because otherwise I would have cut it off. And then you'd have had to marry someone without a nose, and that wouldn't be very nice, would it?
No, ma'am.
I mean, imagine the mess when she got a cold. Yuck!
I think the Blackadder just represented a sort of... It was just one of those happy accidents, really, when a number of creative people at very particular points in their professional careers get together and establish a kind of comic consensus. Although I look back on the Blackadder as a happy time, I know that frequently it was quite fraught. I think creatively it was quite fraught. You know, in the rehearsals with all these, you know, distinct comic energies going on between the writers and the producers and all the actors, a lot of whom were writers in their own right. And this was bound to lead to everyone, let's say, having a view about the material and the jokes that we were trying to crack.
There was lively argument and debate on some of the lines and the timing of them, but it was all good-humoured and full of really brilliant comic invention. I mean, the ideas were thrown around with great enjoyment.
The delectable Patsy Byrne, naughty and saintly by turns and utterly lovable on screen and off, was just one of the many wonderful irregular guests. Peter Cook, Tom Baker, Brian Blessed, Frank Finlay, Jeffrey Palmer, Robbie Coltrane, they all patiently put up with the interminable wrangling in rehearsal as we paced about, struggling to think of a vegetable beginning with C funnier than courgette. Mostly they just sat quietly, listening to the debate with a kind of aghast amusement, but on one occasion when the director popped out for a moment, Frank Finlay came over and said, "For God's sake, will someone tell me what to do?" Mostly it ended well, but Wilfred Bramble, forever famous as Old Steptoe and cast in the small part of a mad lord, became exasperated after 3 hours without getting to his line and left, never to return. Rick Mayall is made of sterner and indeed madder stuff. He does not sit patiently for anyone. Instead, he seizes the bull by its pizzle and chucks it about till it surrenders. Whether by completely rewriting his words, by splattering the furniture with unscheduled pelvic thrusts, or by turning up for the recording in a completely new and never-before-seen wig, Lord Flashheart wiped the floor with Blackadder on numerous occasions.
I always used to love it when people used to come in and be extremely funny, because I always regarded my role in nearly all the Blackadder series as a bit like a master of ceremonies. It was a bit like saying, "Ladies and gentlemen," and then I'd put my hands up and greet the next extremely funny performance. And it was fantastic being able to delegate, if you like, so much of the responsibility for the comedy and for the acting to others, which I was able to do and which I'm very happy to do. I mean, when Rick Mayall came in as Flashheart, he appeared in the fourth series when he played the Royal Flying Corps pilot. I thought it was the performance of his career, actually. I thought he was absolutely hysterical, and I just loved it. And when I look at the episode now, I really do think from Rick's point of view, it was one of the best things he ever did.
Well, 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 if it isn't old Captain Slackbladder.
Blackadder.
Couldn't resist it, eh, Slackbladder? Told you thought I was great. All right, men, let's do it! The first thing to remember is always treat your kite like you treat your woman. How do you mean, sir? Do you mean take her home at the weekend to meet your mother? No, I mean get inside her 5 times a day and take her to heaven and back.
I'm beginning to see why the suffragette movement want the vote.
One of the hallmarks of Blackadder, of course, is the fact that it leaps forward through history with the same characters returning in different combinations like some ghastly karmic prison sentence. But this was never intended at the outset. When Ben Elton joined, he argued for a clean break, getting away from the mud and misery of the Middle Ages and moving into the upbeat, optimistic Elizabethan age. The third series had something of a workshop feel to it, with the actors increasingly contributing to the writing process and making tiny, almost invisible changes to the script. Stephen Fry, for instance, guesting as the irascible Duke of Wellington, found himself with the line, "The King, your father, is mad." At the read-through, he politely asked, "Would you mind if instead I said, 'The King, your father, now believes himself to be a small village in Lincolnshire with spectacular views of the Neen Valley?" Sudden changes of direction like this, right up to the very last minute, were commonplace. They brought both unforeseen delight and perennial problems.
The thing that sometimes held us up was my stammering, because I do have a natural stammer, which I usually manage to contain, particularly when I'm acting and saying lines that I have rehearsed well. It means that I've got very familiar and very confident with them. I mean, stammering is, in the end, a thing about confidence. And normally I was okay, but some words and some phrases did catch me out.
Things went wrong in front of the live audience all the time. It was torture for a live audience. None of us ever knew our words because we never did any rehearsing. All we ever did was argue about the script all week long. So poor old Rowan, when it came to the night, the performance, he was just winging it, really. And he used to dry about 47 times per half hour. He had every justification for doing so, but it can't have been much fun for the audience. It was all right for me. I could just stand around in the background for about 3 minutes thinking, what the hell is my next line? And hopefully I'd remember it just in time and say it.
Nice fireball.
Thank you, Mr. B.
Right, let's get the book. Now, Baldrick, where's the manuscript?
You mean the big papery thing tied up with string?
Yes, Baldrick, the manuscript belonging to Dr. Johnson.
You mean the baity fellow in the black coat who just left?
Yes, Baldrick, Dr. Johnson.
So you're asking where the big papery thing tied up with string belonging to the baity fellow in the black coat who just left is?
Yes, Baldrick, I am. And if you don't answer, then the booted bony thing with five toes on the end of my leg will soon connect sharply with a soft, dangly collection of objects in your sight. For the last time, Baldrick, where is Dr. Johnson's manuscript?
On the fire.
What?
The hot, orangey thing under the standing mantelpiece.
The scripts had always been the source of much passionate disagreement between both the writers themselves and between them and me, but when this widened to include the actors on a regular basis, it became clear that the team would not survive another series. Blackadder Goes Forth had an outrageous premise. Richard and Ben decided it was to be set in the trenches of World War I, surely the epitome of hell on earth. When Ben's uncle, the eminent historian G.R. Elton, first heard of this, he was sufficiently horrified to write his nephew a letter. I agreed with Professor Elton, to be honest, but Ben is no mean historian himself, and he and Richard knew what they were doing. After the last episode, Ben had a second letter from his uncle, who by that time had also been wholly converted. Roan's mailbox was swamped with letters, many from widows of men killed in the First World War, all saying how moved, even grateful, they'd been. I don't remember that we ever had any complaints. When I'd cut the last episode, I brought it home to show my then-girlfriend, now my wife, Sarah. She watched it sitting on the sofa with her back to me as I worked in the kitchen of our little open-plan flat, watching over her shoulder. When the episode finished, the tape simply ran out and she sat unmoving. Fearing that I'd shocked or offended her, or worse, that she'd dozed off, I crept round to look. She was sitting silently, shoulders shaking, looking out into space, her face streaming with tears.
I remember the last episode in the fourth series very, very much. I think it's just that strange contrast of the very funny and the very tragic which you start to feel towards the end of the episode. And I remember feeling as we were rehearsing that episode, feeling this strange sort of knot in my stomach, you know, feeling, I suppose, what the character would feel, because I was aware that at the end of the week, as it were, I was going to go over the top. I was going to, in character, I was going to, and I was sort of living and feeling the dilemma of my character. It was the first and last time that I've ever felt that. But I remember I felt it that week.
Dash and blast all this hanging about, sir! I'm as bored as a pacifist pistol. When are we going to see some action?
Well, George, I strongly suspect that your long wait for certain death is nearly at an end. Surely you must have noticed something in the air?
Well, yes, of course, but I thought that was Private Baldrick.
Unless I'm very much mistaken, soon we will at last be making the final big push. That one we've been so looking forward to all these years.
Well, hurrah with highly polished brass knobs on. About time!
The final scene of Blackadder was a recreation of No Man's Land, never seen in any previous episode, and so enormous that it had to be built in a completely separate studio. The actors were alone, in the dark, with a single assistant floor manager, and had to go over the top, with real explosions going off around them. After the first, shocking take, the studio audience and the production team were stunned into silence. But the director, Richard Bowden, and I felt it could be done a bit better. I spoke into the floor manager's earpiece, and then Roan came on the line. He sounded shattered. I'm sorry, he said, but we can't do another one. It's just too horrible. Over the years, we discussed possible future series. The Blackadder 5 was just one of many ideas. The next was to have been The Six Wives of Blackadder, followed by The Magnificent Seven Blackadders, set in the USA and loosely based on Bonanza. But apart from a one-off special for the Millennium and a tiny commercial for the Queen's Jubilee, with Sir Osmond Darling Blackadder as the keeper of the Queen's lawn sprinkler, filmed in Buckingham Palace, that was to be that.
I think one of the most striking things about it is how it's lasted, actually, is that it doesn't seem to date. is, I suppose it helps that we set the sitcom in, you know, in different periods of British history, and therefore you haven't got, you know, like watching those 70s sitcoms when people seem to have embarrassingly long sideboards and things, and it immediately dates you and distances you from the comedy. Whereas, because we tended to do it in quite a serious way, the most of the programmes look as though they could have been made yesterday.
To me, it was always about problem solving. The first series, how do you make this historical series when no one's ever made one like this before? Second series, how do we make Queen Elizabeth funny? Third series, how do you make a series about the Georgian period when virtually no one in England knows anything about it? Fourth series, how do you make a series about probably the greatest tragedy that the British people were party to in the 20th century? So when I look at the series now, I don't think, oh, that moment was nice, oh, that moment was funny. I think, oh, we solved that particular problem quite well. So they're the emotions that I go through.
The Blackadder series was 6 weeks' work, and I'm quite happy to admit, a 50-year-long career. But that 6 weeks made an enormous difference. Suddenly, you became almost a household name. I still now go to Sainsbury's, and about 8 times every time I go, people say, "Hello, Nursey." I enjoy that. I've also been asked whether I keep my Udders costume in my wardrobe. No.
My general feeling about Blackadder is I feel massively lucky about how it turned out. While we were doing it, I remember saying to Ben, it's good, but it'll never be great. And so it's a surprise that these years later that it lasted so well. And to be honest, you know, I write films most of the time now, and I believe in television more. I think that when you write something of which there are a lot of episodes, they can be a bigger part of people's lives. I think that sitcoms have a way of sort of being part of the texture of the life that you lead. I mean, certainly Python wasn't a sitcom, but Python and Fawlty Towers were that for me. And it's a fantastic thought and big achievement if Blackadder is that for other people.
Today, Rowan Atkinson, as Mr. Bean, is probably the most famous comedian in the whole world. Richard Curtis, through his films Four Weddings and a Funeral and Notting Hill, is arguably the world's best-known comedy writer. The novels, movies, musicals and plays of Ben Elton, Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie have made them international household names, and Tony Robinson is both an award-winning children's writer and an archaeologist. For myself, I retired to the humble world of TV commercials. Much better paid, to be sure, but worth nothing compared to those seminal years of friendship, argument, excitement, panic, and happy hilarity that was Blackadder.
I Have a Cunning Plan was written and presented by John Lloyd and produced in Manchester by Libby Cross.